Welcome to Insight, live at noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. It's been over 5 months since Israel began bombing Gaza following the Hamas attacks on October 7th. Ahead on Insight, we'll hear from a Stockton doctor, born and raised in the West Bank, who just returned from caring for Palestinians in Gaza, trapped in the conflict. Also, we'll speak with a Palestinian author and journalist using food as a way to introduce Gaza to others and keep the memories of those killed in the conflict alive. Finally, the holy month of Ramadan began last night at sundown. We'll get a local perspective on how this time for fasting, reflection, and gathering has taken on a deeper meaning amid the ongoing crisis. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. But first, you know the deal. Here's the news. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Israel-Hamas war has crossed into its fifth month as the world watches a growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. For the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians caught in this conflict, any semblance of stability or safety is hard to come by. The World Health Organization warns hunger is ravaging Gaza, and hospitals are overwhelmed with little supplies. Here at home, there are Palestinian Americans suffering as they try to connect with loved ones in Gaza and offer help in whatever way they can. A Stockton doctor born and raised in the West Bank recently returned from Gaza after spending 2 weeks leading a medical team to provide emergency aid. Dr. Yusuf Kelfa is the co-founder of the Palestinian American Medical Association and joins us with more about his humanitarian mission. Welcome, Dr. Kelfa.
Good afternoon, Vicky, to you and your listeners, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. I know how busy you are. I'd like to start from the beginning. You were born and raised in the West Bank. When did you begin your journey here to Stockton?
Well, I moved to the States in 2006 to have my internal medicine training. I've been between different states, and I moved to Stockton in 2017.
And you are an oncologist. Why did you get into medicine to begin with?
Honestly, that's maybe part of my personal story as a Palestinian, you know, growing up in the midst of military occupation, seeing my people suffering, seeing the healthcare being attacked back home by the Israeli, you know, occupation. I think that slowly built inside of me the dream and the strength to become a physician. And here I am today, trying my best to help my people here. And my people back home also.
You also co-founded a nonprofit, the Palestinian American Medical Association, more than a decade ago in 2013. Why did you start this organization?
I mean, since we moved to the States, we never forgot about Palestine. We were helping at the individual level, but we came to the conclusion that we as a friend, as a co-founder, when we come together, we will do much better. And that was the decision we made. And we founded PAMA in 2013. It's a not-for-profit 501c3 charity aiming to help the healthcare in Palestine, which we have been doing for the past 11 years.
Yeah, and you created this association, you know, as I mentioned, more than a decade ago. Can you help us understand what the healthcare system is like in Gaza and the West Bank?
I can say this medical mission is my number 9. A medical mission. I've been to Gaza several times. The last one was in July. And because of the 17 years plus siege and blockade on Gaza, I mean, the healthcare system in Gaza already was collapsing with a huge shortage of supplies, staff, training. The patients were not allowed to travel abroad to get the treatment that they don't have inside Gaza. A huge shortage of medicine. And the economy there also is collapsing. And now to add to that, in October 7th and the war on Gaza after that, I can tell you, it's already collapsed. Only out of 35 hospitals in Gaza, maybe 8 or 9 partially, barely functioning because of the a lack of fuel, electricity, supplies, staff, and even the attack on the healthcare system. Since day number one, we have witnessed, and there is no discussion or dispute about that. It had been the healthcare system, the hospital, the staff, the physician, are under attack by the Israeli army, and that is making the situation more catastrophic over there.
Mm. You mentioned that before this recent trip, you went to Gaza in July, so that was before October 7th. I can only imagine logistically taking this trip last month would be very difficult. I mean, this is under extreme circumstances. How did you and your team plan this? How did you make a trip like this possible?
Historically, for the first 8 months, we went through the West Bank, through the Ministry of Health. We applied for a permit to the Israeli side. We get the approval. We drive to Erez border and we get to Gaza, period. That was, you know, sort of simple. It was not simple, but let's call it simple now. Now, when it comes to the new situation, it's a new territory through Egypt. I went to Egypt, to Cairo in December of last year. I tried to get to Gaza. I was not allowed. Then I knew about the new channel through the World Health Organization, and I met with them. A lot of restrictions, conditions, security requirements, and the journey was long. I want to thank the World Health Organization. They are the facilitator for this with the Israeli side, but to find, you know, surgeons or a doctor will spend, at least they have to stay in Gaza at least 2 weeks in a war zone, unsafe environment. When we left the U.S., we were not even guaranteed that we would get to Gaza. The 5-6 hour drive between in Cairo to Gaza took us 14 hours. A lot of obstacles, even when we got to Gaza. The first moment you get to Gaza, you only hear the military Israeli drones 24/7 in the sky. And when you get to the hospital where we stayed, the Yerevan hospitals, every 15 to 20 minutes you hear the Israeli bombs around the hospital, the building shaking. I remember two nights before we left, there was a very close bombing to the near to the hospital, that the ceiling fell off on us, and it was very terrifying. And I can tell you, the hospital is full of at least 25,000 Palestinians who were displaced. They are just seeking refugee in the hospital. The hospital occupancy is about 350% of its normal occupancy. And I tell you something, it was very hard. We thought about death every hour, every day. And we only endured that for 14 days. How about the children of Gaza who has been enduring this? Now, we started the 6th month of the war. They have been enduring this. The Palestinian women, the elderly, the whole Palestinian people in Gaza, they have been suffering, talking about bombing them, killing them. There are now about 17,000 orphans in Gaza because they lost their parents. Women has their own need. They are lacking. People were talking to me. They were displaced at least 5 times from place. They told them this is a safe place. Then they told them to move, then move, then move. They lost everything. I talked to a man who lost all his family members. And I remember him talking about his daughter, Layla. She was 2 years old. And he said one thing. The only thing that he is sad, the saddest about, that he was not able to bury her because she's still under the rubble for the past 2 months. And now we have in the northern part of Gaza, the starvation. This is a collective punishment to my people. This should not happen in our time. Our administration taking big part of this, if not the major part, they can stop that. And there's a lot of blood on the hands of our administration that no amount of water or soap can wash it away.
Yeah. I mean, you are Palestinian. You are also a physician, a doctor. So I can understand, you know, why you would want to take a trip like this to offer emergency aid to people that it's so hard to come by. On the other hand, you also have a family here at home. You have a wife who is also Palestinian. You have 3 children. What conversations did you have as a family before deciding to embark on this trip? As you said, there was no assurance of safety or security.
I had a discussion with my wife. My kids did not know about me going there until I entered Gaza. It was a big concern, but, you know, I told my wife and she agreed that someone has to do that. And if it's written for me to come back, I'll come back. And, you know, I could come back and drive from SFO2 my home and have a car accident and die. If everyone say not me, then who will be the one who's doing it? The people, my people in Gaza, 2.3 million Palestinians deserve the sacrifice. What I have done, what my colleagues have done, is nothing compared to what they are enduring and what they have sacrificed. People sacrificed all what they have, all their family members, children, wives, parents, houses, money, everything. And they are the victims of this. And again, I'm calling not only on our administration, calling upon our community, our Americans fellow. I am a proud Palestinian American, and I say that loudly. They need to learn the Palestinian narrative. They need, this has to come to the scene, and they have to act and make the pressure on the elected officials and our administration, because our tax money is what is being used to bomb and kill my people. And then, you know, I can tell you something. One of the saddest scene I've seen when in my trip to Gaza is that lines of thousands of humanitarian aid trucks waiting over miles and miles of distance and not being allowed. Our administration can make this happen. Who needs the airdropping? The airdropping they are doing is nothing. It's a drop in the ocean compared to what they aren't able to do if they allow that the trucks going in to Gaza. So they need to do their part again. And we are, as American fellows, we need to make the pressure. Our tax money goes for the bombing of my people, and we need to make the pressure on the administration to let that humanitarian aid goes in. And let me tell you something. The people of Gaza do not need that aid if they are not being bombed. That would just stop bombing them is the biggest help and aid you can do to them.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Yousef Khelfa, a Palestinian-American doctor here in Stockton, who recently returned from an emergency medical aid mission to Gaza. You have mentioned elected officials. Have you had any communication with government officials here, locally, statewide, or even nationally?
We have a meet with our governor, Mr. Newsom, and we expressed our disagreement with what's going on. That was, I remember a couple of months ago, we reached Josh Harder, congressman. We do a peaceful protest almost every weekend. We send a lot of petitions to pressure on to make a permanent ceasefire and to let the people go back to their home. But let me tell you something. We only hear words, even from our president, our administration, Mr. Blinken. It only words that make us feel calm. Okay, they were going to make in 2 months, a port in Gaza to help the people. So are you telling me for the next 2 months, it's okay for my people to continue to be killed? They can do better. They can stop this war. They can and they should, but they don't. And again, we need to make them feel the pressure about what that we are watching, and that's wrong, and they have to stop that. So all what we have heard from all the officials, it just works. They are not listening. So we need to make the pressure even more impactful.
And as you know, we're in an election year. We just had the primary last Tuesday. Leading up to the primary, there were lots of debates, whether it was for Senate here in California or other positions. And a topic of these conversations to see where hopeful elected officials stand on this issue between Israel and Hamas can be enlightening. What do you make of the argument that some people have who are running for office that they stand with Israel and that they are on the side of the Israeli government, arguing that Hamas is responsible for this death toll because they're operating within civilian areas? I mean, you have been there yourself recently. What do you say in response to that argument?
Well, my response will be on the ballot. My vote will be the biggest answer to them, and the people here who are believe in the Palestinian justice and they deserve this freedom and like any human being. That will be our answer. Will be on the vote. I've been to Gaza 9 times, especially in the hospitals, of course. I have never seen any military, acts inside the hospital. Let me tell you something. So I'm going to be now more specific about the hospitals that are being targeted directly over and over and over. with the false accusation that there is a military, you know, I never witnessed that. And even let me tell you something. Let's make the assumption of that if this happened in certain area. Does that give you the excuse to bomb the hospital with the patients with the doctors? We don't do this. This is that should not be, you know, something to be done. But again, I've been either in this medical mission or the ones before. I never had any witnessed any military and, you know, and activities inside the hospital. It was a pure patient's care that, you know, we have been doing with our colleagues. And more than 300 of my colleagues has been killed. Dozens are being have been abducted and being tortured, and we got the news they are being tortured. And again, out of 36 hospital, 8-9 barely functioning for a 2.3 million population, that should not happen. So back to your question, our vote will be the answer, and their argument does not make sense.
As someone who's from that region, still offering and returning to offer medical aid, I mean, you really understand this deeply tenuous relationship among the Israeli government Palestinians over the decades, not just since October 7th. What are the biggest misconceptions that you work to dismantle?
Well, I mean, I'm telling you, we are, as a Palestinian, we want peace. That's for a fact. But we want the real peace, a two-state solutions. And that what has been, you know, discussing, and we have not seen anything with that since Oslo agreements. You know, we have seen more and more of settlement building. We have seen more checkpoints. We have been seeing more, you know, detention of our, you know, my people, killing. So, again, the people here in the States, they need to know the two narratives, that Palestinians, they want peace. And we have been sacrificing a lot to achieve that. But all what we have heard from the Israeli administration over and the government over the years, and even the U.S., is just a talk about two states solution. We have not seen anything there. So I hope that, you know, that is a beginning for a new era, though maybe I doubt seeing that with the pro-Israeli one-sided view in the U.S. administration. But I really pray that this will change very soon. And our vote should work on making this happen sooner.
Yeah, as we wind down this conversation, you are now back at home. You're in Stockton. You're talking to us, taking breaks in between being an oncologist, being a doctor. How was it to return home following a trip like this? To return, and what? How did you talk about this with your children, your young children?
It's not easy. I have to be honest. I need to admit that it's not easy. It's a lot of a trauma. I feel sometimes better when I talk to people about it. Just sharing what I have seen, the huge amount, I mean, of the casualty, the kind of the casualty we have seen there, the bombing, the explosive bombing injuries that we have seen. You know, I try my best to raise my children that they always stand for justice. It doesn't matter where it stands, whether it's at the Palestinian, Israeli, or the U.S. side. So I talk to them how the children of Gaza have been suffering, not only for the past 5 months, past 18 years plus, the blockade. I love the children of Gaza. They always give me strength when I meet with them. I see myself in their eyes because I've been there. I grew up in the West Bank and under the military occupation, and I know how it's hard to be treated as a subhuman. And that the message also I want to share with the people here, that, you know, Palestinians are not subhumans. We are as human as you, they are as you are, as anyone, and they should be treated as is. And until then, there will be no solution, because we see the one-sided, you know, support to the Israeli side, because they don't view the Palestinians as humans. But we are, and they tried to make me feel that, but they failed. And here I am now, I'm in the States, I'm a physician, I'm helping my American fellows here, I'm helping my people back home, And I persist and I say I am Palestinian. I am a proud Palestinian American and I am a human like all the Palestinians. And we will continue our journey until, you know, we have our freedom and we have justice like any other nation.
Dr. Khalfa, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your recent trip.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Yousef Khalfa is a doctor from Stockton and the co-founder of the Palestinian American Medical Association, discussing his recent trip to Gaza to provide emergency medical care to Palestinians. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We just heard from a Palestinian-American doctor from Stockton who returned from a humanitarian mission offering emergency medical aid to Gaza. According to the Associated Press, since Hamas launched an attack on Israelis on October 7th, the health ministry in Gaza reports at least 31,000 Palestinians have been killed and that women and children make up two-thirds of the dead. And that death toll is deeply felt here by Palestinian Americans, many of whom have lost loved ones in Gaza. That devastating reality is one that is being discussed at length in Sacramento. Leila El Haddad is a Palestinian writer and author from Gaza. Leila spent time in Sacramento this past Thursday at Sac City College discussing the ongoing crisis and sharing how she uses food to humanize the stories of Palestinians and to keep the memories of family members killed in the conflict alive. Leila joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, of course. Thank you for taking the time. And I hope you got back home safe after being here in Sacramento last week. Can you briefly introduce yourself to listeners? You have a very lengthy career as a writer, as an author, and also as a journalist.
I'm as you said, a Palestinian writer, an author. I'm based in Maryland. I also spent many years in Gaza, where my family all resides and where I spent a lot of my childhood and all of my summers, and co-author of a book called The Gaza Kitchen, A Palestinian Culinary Journey. That's a sort of ethnographic approach to, it's a cookbook, first and foremost. About the Palestinian cuisine of Gaza, but also uses a kind of ethnographic approach to exploring, using the food of lens to explore the situation in Gaza that we published many years ago, but it's still as relevant as ever, given the current situation.
Yeah, I follow you on Instagram, and your handle is Gaza Mom. And I was looking at a post that you had from last month about hosting a benefit dinner and using food as a way to raise awareness for what is unfolding and continuing to unfold in Gaza. What has food and cuisine and the culture behind it, how has that led to really a tool to educate others and to raise awareness during this time?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'll backtrack. You know, when we first wrote the book, my co-author and I, even then it was with great difficulty that we were able to get to Gaza. Even myself as a Palestinian with a Gaza ID and paperwork and family, but even then it was difficult. And we felt, we intuited that this was something that was necessary, something, a piece of work like this, not only to as a tool of education, but really as a means to be able to document the cuisine that we felt was also itself under siege and under fire, and be able to provide it for other Palestinians who were, you know, either forcibly removed from their homeland or dispossessed of it and of their heritage. But also, as you said, as a means indeed to, through this lens of food, to educate others about the situation. And our intuition was correct then, and even years later, you know, not that we want it to be correct, unfortunately, Gaza is yet again, you know, facing an even more brutal onslaught and genocide. And there's been renewed interest in the book and in understanding. I think for a lot of people, Gaza is this, you know, abstraction that's really difficult to understand, that only conjures up images of destruction and destitution and bombardment. And while that is certainly part of the story, and especially now, there's also this whole other side of it, right? It has a very rich history. It was always the nexus between civilizations and the crossroads of all the different spice routes, and had a prosperous hub along the Mediterranean. It's very difficult to think of Gaza in that way, but it's more commonly historically known as a place that was rich and known for its hospitality, and you know, cited often by different traders that would pass through. So I often find that audiences, and even journalists, I had a, you know, an interesting conversation with a journalist for CBS, who don't or can't otherwise, or even won't otherwise, want to know about Gaza, are able to do so through this medium, because it's also, everything is interconnected. It's not, you know, food tells a larger story, as we know. And in the case of Gaza in particular, what we see now is, and what we have seen, it's been an extension of a longstanding policy, but in a much more brazen and sort of pernicious manner now, is the deliberate targeting of Gaza's foodways and control over those foodways as well. So Oxfam and, you know, the World Food Organization and others have noted that Israel has systematically been targeting, it started off by targeting the farms, the agricultural assets, you know, the irrigation, and this extends, of course, to the sea. And again, this is part of a longstanding 17-year-long policy under the Israeli blockade of Gaza, where it has severely restricted and controlled and destroyed the food system. And so while we weave, you know, I weave in, obviously, and as you said, I had a benefit in which we like to highlight and showcase the food, traditional foods of Gaza, because I feel like that in and of itself is important in humanizing, rehumanizing, unfortunately, Palestinians, since dehumanization has been very much a part of the policy of the attack on Gaza. It's also an introduction for people to the region, and to be able to then begin this more difficult and uncomfortable conversation about all the things that I just mentioned, about the genocide, the attack on the foodways, the deliberate starvation, and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, as I'm learning from you, I mean, food is powerful. It's more than just food. It can really open minds. And I would just think, obviously, it's even more poignant that we're having this conversation now in light of everything that's unfolding. You also said you have family members in Gaza. Have you been able to keep in touch with them? Do you know how they're doing?
Yes, I have several dozen family members throughout the Gaza Strip. Several of them have been displaced multiple times or in the south, but about the majority are in the north, in Gaza City. We have intermittent communication, so more so with those in the south that are often able to update us on those in the north. And that's important. We try our best to stay in touch. I think it's also important for them to feel that we are thinking of them, that we are doing for them, that they are not abandoned, and they are not alone, which they often express is kind of their biggest fear, that people will just forget about them. But the situation is dire, as your previous guest noted, and others who have recently been there have also noted, most notably Palestinian writer Susan Abulhawa, who had just come back and said it's far worse than you know, anyone can imagine. And despite that, they try to keep, you know, in best spirits as they can. But they have been without power now for months. You know, it's almost become, you know, the abnormal has unfortunately, and we shouldn't make it, we shouldn't normalize it, but they've been without any electricity for all these months now, as, you know, Israeli officials said they would cut off the power, and they did, and not allow fuel in, and they have done just that. So they've been cooking largely with whatever they can find, pieces of wood, charcoal. They've had to kind of create these, you know, small ovens out of old, you know, tin cans, or make clay ovens. And not everyone has that kind of knowledge. I mean, at least my family members mostly were professionals who were teaching, you know, universities and bankers and pharmacists and so forth. So, but that's what they've had to resort to doing to survive. And it's especially difficult for my cousins in the north of Gaza, who have not had steady or regular access to clean water or to any kind of, you know, animal protein or fruits or vegetables. They've largely been relying on things like animal feed to bake bread with, or whatever canned foods they can get their hand on, or beans or lentils. So it's very harrowing. And yet my cousin told me, she sent me a picture of a group of people on her street in Gaza City who had put up a very large decorative lantern in the street just to try to, you know, celebrate, to feel, to sort of break this violence that has been leashed upon them, to celebrate Ramadan with, of course, lanterns being a fixture of the month. And I heard the call to prayer in the background, and she told me, you know, don't be fooled. That's not an actual, usually Muslim call to prayers are made 5 times a day. Live by a muadzin from the mosque. And she said that's just a recording that people are amplifying on their phones because, again, there's no operational mosques. More than 1,000 mosques have been destroyed fully or partially. And so she said people are just playing the call to prayer just so, you know, we can feel, we can hear it, and we can feel that there is some kind of routine or normality, and people were praying out on the streets instead of the mosques for their daily prayers.
I mean, I think about, you know, your loved ones in Gaza, and I also think about you professionally as an author, also a journalist. You were formerly a Gaza correspondent. You're a regular contributor on BBC World News. I mean, are you able to compartmentalize all of this? I mean, there's obviously a very deep personal connection, but then you also have this perseverance and this mission to talk and to hold events like you were just in Sacramento last week to talk about Gaza, rehumanizing Gazans, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I don't have a choice, but I absolutely have to sometimes compartmentalize. But, you know, there's moments that are really difficult. When I testified in the federal court in Oakland in January for the lawsuit that I and others were filing against the Biden administration for their complicity in genocide, and that was really difficult, you know, having to relay what my family members were going through, speaking about my aunt and my cousins who were killed in an Israeli airstrike in their home in November. And sometimes I do have to kind of separate my worlds, but I think it's also important to use our voices as Palestinians to narrate our own experiences, kind of echoing the late Edward Said in his seminal essay, Permission to Narrate. I think that's what's been missing largely from the coverage. And I feel as an American and as a Palestinian and as a human being, frankly, with family in Gaza specifically, it's my, and as a taxpayer, it's, you know, I'm obligated to speak out and to, you know, muster up whatever energy I have in the most effective way. And I recognize that not everyone can do that. To speak out on their behalf, to advocate on their behalf, to organize, in you know, whatever, with whatever tools and knowledge that I have. And I think that's something that they have mandated me with, my family members, and they keep saying that's so important, and we really want you to keep doing this. And so, so I do it. You know, there's no alternative. The alternative is to, you know, silence this complicity, to sit by. And And also, frankly, it's somewhat cathartic because we're just overwhelmed with sadness and anger, and it can eat you alive. So you have to just convert that into something that you feel is making a difference. And it's not easy, because you sit here and you see the numbers, and it's like unlike anything we've seen in recent history. It's the fastest occurring genocide in recent history, according to humanitarian organizations. And you see that close to 50,000 Palestinians have been killed, including those who have bodies have not been retrieved. And you see that you know that your government can stop it, that President Biden can stop it with a single phone call, and is deliberately choosing not to. And I think that's what makes it all so difficult.
In the last few minutes that we have, when you were here in Sacramento, tell us about the events that you were part of and what the focus of your conversations were.
I was speaking to students in the afternoon and to a community in the evening, and it ran the gamut from speaking about what my family members are enduring, what I've been up to in terms of organizing, as I said, the lawsuit that we filed against the Biden administration and the appeal to that's been ongoing, and why that's significant and important as well, about recent work I've done writing in terms of a piece I had in Savour magazine talking about my late aunt and, the culinary legacy with which she left me. It was just a broader conversation as well about the history of Gaza. And again, it's just keeping those conversations going. I try to reach new audiences. I was especially impressed with the how invested the students were. And they were great listeners and had really, I think, very insightful questions. And I really appreciate that, because that means that people are, taking note, they're listening, they're learning. And that's always, to me, the first step is, educating and informing others and learning yourself about a situation in which we, as Americans are directly complicit.
Hmm. You mentioned the lawsuit that you are part of, and it's currently in the appeals process. A federal judge in Oakland dismissed the lawsuit last month. It's now moving forward in the process. What would you like people to know about this lawsuit? Because we did have Bassem El-Khara on. He leads CARE's efforts here in the Sacramento Valley. He testified along with you for this lawsuit, and CARE is the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He focuses here on Sacramento. What do you want people to know about this lawsuit as it continues to make its way through the legal process?
Well, it sounds like, Bassem did a great job of summarizing, but essentially it was... We were suing President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin for their failure to prevent an ongoing genocide, which is, of course, illegal under the Geneva Convention, to which the U.S. is a signatory, and for their complicity in that genocide by providing financial and diplomatic and military cover. And what was really significant about it, because often people might say, what are the limits to... the courts or the limits of the law, and what's the point? And I think it was really significant. It came at a moment in time when a lot of us we still are, but really completely broken as Palestinian Americans with family in Gaza, feeling like no matter what we were doing or saying, not only was not being heard, but our voices and our families, deaths were actively being erased, invisibilized, as the Biden administration, even cast that into question, their deaths into question, and failed to mention them even on the 100th day of the genocide. So having that space in which we could share our stories, share their stories, have lengthy discussion of, not just what's happening now, but the history of Palestinian dispossession and the Palestinian Nakba of 1948, or the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, and how that pertains to today, to what we're seeing now, providing that context and having that on the court record was incredibly powerful. And it's of significance that President Biden is the only sitting president now having been accused of a plausible genocide. And I think that if nothing, it continues to add pressure, and as we've seen, to shift the course of this administration's policy on Gaza and hopefully, in the right direction to put an end to this genocide and unwavering, unflagging U.S. support for Israel. the appeals will continue to accomplish.
Thank you so much, Leila, for joining us and taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Leila El-Haddad is a Palestinian author and writer from Gaza, and she was in Sacramento last week talking about the ongoing crisis and also the connections between food, politics, and cultural preservation. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Today, we have been discussing the ongoing crisis in Gaza with Palestinian Americans. And now we want to turn our attention to Ramadan. Just as we did a few months back with Hanukkah, we're exploring holy periods through the lens of local people who have deep connections to the war zone. And as we'll learn, Ramadan is a time for fasting, reflection, and communal gatherings. And that, of course, takes on a deeper meaning with the ongoing war in Gaza and the deepening famine crisis. Dr. Heba Hamdan is a Palestinian American and an internal medicine doctor at UC Davis Health in Roseville, and she has a unique perspective on Ramadan and joins us now from her office in Roseville. Thanks for taking the time, Dr. Hamdan.
Thank you, Vicky. I'm also a kidney doctor, too, and I love kidneys, so I have to mention that I'm a kidney doctor.
Of course. They are important. So thank you for that passion. Let's start with Ramadan 101. It started at sunset yesterday. For those who don't know the specifics, what is Ramadan and what does it mean to practicing Muslims like yourself?
Yes, absolutely. So Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic lunar calendar. The Islamic calendar follows a lunar citation. So Ramadan is the ninth month. It usually moves by 10 to 12 days forward on our calendar. And it starts by sighting the moon. Traditionally, usually families go out and sight the moon. And that marks the beginning of the month. It's a very festive month, usually. During the day, it's observed by abstaining from eating and drinking from sunrise to sunset. And then the breakfast meal, usually at sunset, is very festive. It's celebrated with many different traditions throughout the Muslim world, with different foods, different drinks, to nourish the fasting body. And then, fasting is kind of viewed as a spiritual and body cleansing process. And then the night kind of starts a communal worship and spirituality session, so to speak. So after people break fast, people usually go to mosques or at their homes, within their families. They pray, they worship, or they meditate to kind of connect with God and reflect on the great things that they have and be grateful.
Yeah, when you have this period of self-reflection for yourself, How powerful is it for you to do it each year, and what do you reflect on?
It is very powerful and very cleansing. And, I have two little, they don't like me call them little anymore, but I have two girls. One is going to be 14 in a few months and one is 11. But, you would think that a month where you're going to not eat or drink during the day is a month that they don't like, but they are waiting for it. They're counting the days down just because, of the spirituality, the community. One of the things that we talk about which is exceptionally painful to talk about now. Every time we sit at our breakfast table, which is usually thankfully very full, we think of the people, you know, who fast not willingly or who fast not because it's a choice that they make. We think of the people who don't really have all that we have to break fast with. And that incites a powerful sense of gratitude. And it also incites a powerful kind of duty and obligation to give and share with those who don't really have all that we are blessed with. So I think that's very deep. That's a very deep message that's relayed by the month of Ramadan. And the spirituality, especially the tradition, is that, you know, you fast during the day and you pray or meditate during the night. I can't tell you how many times I sat there praying or meditating and cried, just reflecting on a bigger meaning of the world, reflecting on what things I'm grateful for, reflecting on the people in my life that I'm grateful for. So it's truly a deeply kind of cleansing process, both the spirituality of the night and the fasting during the day.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there are Muslims all over the world. I mean, how is Ramadan celebrated and observed in the U.S.? Is it different than other places?
You know, I love, just like Dr. Yusuf Khilfa said, you know, I'm a very proud Palestinian American. And I was speaking to one of my friends yesterday. We were talking about cooking. And I feel like now I cook this mishmash of different, you know, ethnicities and cultures and, you know, Palestinian food with an infusion of Mexican, food in it. So in the United States, it's actually very beautiful because you get to experience different traditions that you didn't necessarily experience. Like, I grew up mostly in Jordan, but the lanterns, the different foods. I mean, I love pakoras for my Desi friends. It's a special type of appetizer that, you know, gets served during Ramadan. I love all, you know, mixing all the different traditions, Egyptian traditions, Syrian traditions, Palestinian, you know, all different kinds of traditions come together, which really for me makes it that much more rich.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, and I love that. I mean, especially in an area like Sacramento and adjoining Placer County as well, is very diverse. So you can incorporate other cuisines and cultures when you break fast together and celebrate that. I do have some friends who celebrate Ramadan, and they were journalists, and just being out in the field, I mean, that can be difficult. You know, you're a doctor, so naturally you see things through a medical lens. Are there restrictions on who can and cannot fast for Ramadan?
Yes, absolutely. I have to tell you, Vicky, the one thing that I miss during my fast is my coffee. everything else I can go without. Obviously, I mean, it's clear in Islamic tradition that you, you know, your body is sacred. It's a gift that God gives you. You cannot do anything that jeopardizes the safety of your body. So only people who are healthy enough to fast are allowed to fast. So, you know, I and many Muslims are also very cognizant of hydrating very well during the night, you know, eating the right types of foods. Traditionally, Muslims eat dates because they're very rich in carbohydrates with fibers and also lots of vitamins. There's a lot of medical benefits for fasting. You know, as you know, most probably now intermittent fasting is used medically for weight loss. It's also been shown to sharpen the memory, allow your cells to rejuvenate. So I think when done correctly in the right contexts for people who are healthy enough to handle it, it's very safe. I do miss the coffee. Like the first day for Eid al-Fitr, which is like the festival that comes after Ramadan, I'm rushing down the stairs to get my coffee. That's the one thing.
I can imagine. As a coffee drinker myself, that is the first thing I have in the morning as well. And that was going to bring me to my last question. We only have about 60 seconds left, but you mentioned Eid. How is it celebrated? What are you looking forward to?
So, I mean, the best thing about Eid for me is coming together with my friends and coming together with my friends who have actually become my family, because my family is not here. You know, we dress up, we celebrate that we've completed fasting the month of Ramadan. We share some gifts. We have, you know, communal meals together, and we spend a fun day with friends that you know, the girls look forward to. There's also a prayer at the beginning of the day, just again, to be thankful for all that the blessings that we have, and encourage us to continue to be charitable towards those who are in need.
Dr. Hamdan, thank you so much for joining us and giving us a 101 and also what it means to you personally with your family.
Thank you so much, Vicky.
Dr. Heba Hamdan is a Palestinian American and an internal medicine, also kidney doctor, at UC Davis Health in Roseville, discussing Ramadan, which began last night. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.